Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, how was your week? I hope it was filled with good experiences and you got a lot of benefit from them. We're looking at a text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, written by the Tibetan master Namkar Pal. It's a text that focuses on bodhicitta especially, that is, the determination to attain enlightenment so we can best benefit others. Of course, as has been so often pointed out, we experience our own good fortune by the way. In any case, we've reached the point that talks about the advantages of developing bodhicitta, so that we have something to aim for while engaging in practice. So having said that, let's take a minute, as we usually do, to set our motivation for being together and participating in the Dharma, and let that motivation be bodhicitta. As we've explained before, this is the best, with the greatest benefit for our mind. So if we can, we should definitely make that our motivation. If you really can't, though, at least make your own liberation from samsara your purpose. Okay, thank you. Now, last week, I ended with a quote from a teaching by Lama Yeshe I used in the three principal aspects of a path. But that teaching is so nice, I'm going to go through it again. Perhaps I can make the excuse that we are told to hear the teachings again and again for them to make a good impression on our minds. Lama Yeshe asks, in our relationships, why do we sometimes say, I love you, and sometimes I hate you? Where does this up and down mind come from? He's asking us to look at what is behind this pendulum of emotion that swings to and fro between the extremes of love and hate, not only for different people, like I like James but I hate Peter, but even for the same person. Now, it comes from the Daily Mail, and so may count as true confessions rather than erudite research, but a 9th of August 2010 article entitled Do I Love Him or Do I Hate Him? By Lucy Taylor may make some sense of this. Taylor writes, a few years ago, I was embroiled in a long, frustrating, and ultimately painful game of commitment tango with a tall, dark, and handsome doctor. After several drunken snogs, we settled into a bizarre dance, tiptoeing around an intensely palpable but undeclared chemistry. When he advanced, I retreated, and vice versa. One moment, I would feel overwhelming infatuation for him. The next, I'd find an insurmountable flaw. This ridiculous pattern continued for more than 3 years until he, clearly having had enough of this tricky and illogical game, met someone else and married her within 6 months. I was heartbroken. He was the one, I sobbed to my ever-patient friends. It was only when this man was no longer available that any trace of doubt evaporated and my feelings of undying love suddenly became crystal clear and all-consuming. All flaws were forgotten and he was transformed in my screwed-up mind into a godlike creature, a Mr. Perfect. Embarrassingly, I spent the next 3 years or so pining for him, fantasizing that his marriage wouldn't last and that we would eventually enjoy a wonderful, conflict-free life together. I made it impossible for myself to have any hope of forming another relationship because I was so preoccupied with the man of my dreams. No wonder they say love is a game, a mystery, a madness. I was reminded of all this when a friend who's due to get married in October drunkenly confessed she was having major reservations about her husband-to-be. When we met, it was like a gust of wind that swept me off my feet, she said. but at the moment I can't stand the sight of him. Everything he does irritates me. The way he tucks his shirt into his jeans, the fact that he clips his nails. I can hardly bear to be in the same room. She wondered if this meant that she didn't love him anymore and should call off the wedding. In the past, I'd have interpreted these feelings as red flags and would probably have advised her to run a mile. But these days, I'm not so sure. Extreme and contradictory feelings, I have come to realize, seem to be a difficult but unavoidable aspect of intimate relationships. Psychologists call this ambivalence, or, for reasons that will become clear, the Hamlet syndrome. They say most people don't fully understand what it is, but argue that an ability to manage it is essential for a happy and contented life. So what exactly is ambivalence? We often use it to describe mixed feelings or even indifference. But what it really means is the coexistence of strong contradictory impulses and emotions, such as love and hate, or kindness and hostility towards the same person. Some experts say many women first consciously experience ambivalence when they have a baby. They talk privately about having a deep and all-consuming love for their child, but at the same time, there can be fleeting or not so fleeting feelings of anger and helplessness towards the baby when it howls for hours. In the book Being in Love, psychotherapist Judith Pickering says one of the most confusing aspects of intimate relationships is the contradictory feelings they evoke. We are not good at reconciling the fact that we might feel a range of conflicting sentiments, overwhelming infatuation, followed by irritation, boredom, resentment, jealousy, possessiveness, all for the one person in varying degrees at varying times. We can feel desire towards our partner one day and repugnance or indifference the next. An inability to tolerate these confusing feelings can, she believes, lead people to behave in ways that are not in their best long-term self-interest. Other experts go even further. Neil Rosenthal, a marriage and family therapist, believes that ambivalence is the most pervasive reason why relationships don't get off the ground, or why they get sabotaged, even though they appear to have promise. It is also, he believes, why relationships that start off with so much closeness and passion gradually grow stale, distant, and cold. Ambivalence is about receiving a double message, usually in actions rather than words. I want you more than anything, but I have a lot of other priorities as well, so don't expect a lot from me. Or, I want our relationship to be as intimate as possible, but I'm not going to allow myself to get too close, just in case things don't work out between us. Taylor goes on to write, "This apparently bewildering behavior would certainly help explain the frustration another friend is experiencing. A couple of months ago, she met the man of her dreams. He told her she was gorgeous, clever, interesting, and sexy. On their third date, he spoke about whisking her off to New York. Then he disappeared, refusing to return her calls. He got back in touch a couple of weeks later, apologized, and told her she was amazing. But then, another few weeks later, he bolted again. This happened four times. She knows through a mutual friend who knows him well that he isn't married or hiding a secret double life. Though puzzling and frustrating for my friend, psychologists would say his behavior is understandable and could be explained, at least partly, by an ambivalence of which he was probably not even aware. It is similar to Hamlet in his famous to be or not to be soliloquy, says Rosenthal. You act indecisively, half-heartedly, and are non-committal, thereby dampening or sabotaging the relationship you claim to value so much. Taylor says that an inability to deal with ambivalence may lead people to being stuck in a swamp of indecision or acting out by, for instance, having an affair. It can also mean people end up just drifting through their lives. Taylor writes, they may say they're just going with the flow, but what they're really doing is letting other people make their big life decisions for them because they can't face their own contradictory feelings. At the same time, when we are unable to tolerate strong conflicting emotions, we tend to put others on a pedestal and see them as completely flawless, or we can hardly bear to pass the time of day. Taylor claims, like kids, we tend to see the world as black and white, good or bad, right or wrong, joyful or depressed. For the same reason, we create heroes and villains. And that means, she says, we're not particularly good at living with the anxiety and ambivalence and ambiguity of life in the middle, in the vast grey area. She writes, looking back, I see this as a feature of so many of my experiences. I had a tendency to bolt at the first sign of negative feelings. I remember in my early 30s being with a man I fell head over heels in love with. Once the initial passion had worn off, I oscillated between loving and hating him. I didn't realize that this was normal. I simply couldn't handle the opposing feelings, though I didn't realize that at the time. I just thought I didn't really love him, and eventually called it off. When I think about what I was like in my 20s and early 30s, I had wildly conflicting fears I couldn't seem to reconcile. There was part of me that wanted desperately to settle down and have children, but there was another part of me that was terrified of giving up my independence and of being trapped in a relationship with someone I wasn't truly, madly, deeply in love with. If only I'd known then that this was actually quite normal, that no one feels madly, truly, deeply in love all the time, I probably wouldn't have ended up messing up so many relationships. It's not just in the romantic sphere in which ambivalence is a factor. For years, I blindly idealized my mum. At the same time, I denigrated my dad. I thought he wasn't good enough for her, didn't appreciate her enough, or realize how lucky he was. It was only recently that I realized how infantile this was and how complicated intimate and long-term relationships are. I now try to treat them equally. Similarly, I found myself sabotaging a couple of close friendships over the years. Again, I think it was because I couldn't handle the confusing, conflicting feelings that are a byproduct of all but the most superficial relationship. So, why are some of us, psychologists would say most of us, whether we realize it or not, ambivalent in our closest relationships? Rosenthal suggests several reasons. Because we are afraid. We fear being exposed. We don't want to be rejected. We're afraid of making the same mistakes we've made in the past. We fear allowing ourselves to become too vulnerable. We don't want to risk being dumped. We fear being known. We're afraid of being tied down. We're afraid that anyone who gets to know us too well won't want us anymore. And that's just a partial list. Unfortunately, we live in a culture that is uncomfortable with the existence of ambivalence. We are expected to love our partners, children, and friends completely and constantly, truly, madly, deeply. Now, this may work in fairy tales, but in real life, relationships are simply never that straightforward. Lama Yeshe brings another interpretation of the reason for the ambivalence in our relationships. He says it is all down to self-cherishing and a lack of bodhicitta. He claims, what we are saying is, I hate you because I'm not getting any satisfaction from you. You hurt me, you don't give me pleasure. That's the whole thing. I, my ego, my attachment, am not getting satisfaction from you, therefore I hate you. What a joke. All the difficulties in interpersonal relationships come from not having bodhicitta, from not having changed our minds. He says that meditation is not enough, that in addition we have to cultivate bodhicitta. He says, you can prove scientifically that bodhicitta is the best practice to do. Our self-cherishing thought is the root of all human problems. It makes our lives difficult and miserable. The solution to self-cherishing, its antidote, is the mind that is its complete opposite, bodhicitta. The self-cherishing mind is worried about only me, the self-existent I. Bodhicitta substitutes others for self. It creates space in your mind. Then even if your dearest friend forgets a Christmas present, you don't mind. Oh well, this year she didn't give me my chocolates. It doesn't matter. Anyway, your human relationships are not for chocolate, not for sensory pleasures. Something much deeper can come from our being together, working together. If you want to be really, really happy, it isn't enough just to space out in meditation. Many people who have spent years alone in meditation have finished up the worst for it. Coming back into society, they've freaked out. They haven't been able to take contact with other people again because the peaceful environment they created was an artificial condition, still a relative phenomenon without solidity. Now, I've heard this argument before, but just because some don't benefit from years solitary meditating doesn't automatically mean nobody can attain realizations or happiness doing so. In 2013, Ajahn Sona from the Birken Forest Monastery in Canada did a year-long solitary retreat, before which he gave an interview on northwestdharma.org in which he pointed to the monks of the Buddha's time retreating in solitude. He says, "The fully enlightened monks of the time of the Buddha continued to practice deeply and, very importantly, continued to enter into deep states of concentration called the jhanas. It is crucial to understand this here in the West, where practitioners are frequently introduced to Buddhism through Vipassana schools where there is no emphasis on jhana or deep samadhi. We should refer to the historical facts to see that the fully enlightened monks of the Buddha's time continued to enter into these deep states and appreciated long periods of time in seclusion even after their enlightenment. Although I'm not comparing myself to the fully enlightened monks at the time of the Buddha, even more so should a monk of this time carve out periods of time where there are no teaching or administrative duties and where he can cultivate the deeper stillness practices of samadhi. This is more or less my job. If I did not do this, I would be somewhat negligent as a monk." In Thailand, where there are some 35,000 monasteries, abbots and senior monks often leave their own monasteries for such retreats and go off to other related branch monasteries where their solitude can be supported and where they are secluded from the practical demands of their own communities. When the Buddha went into retreat, he said to his attendant Ananda, "People may ask what I am doing in my 3-month retreat. You may tell them, Ananda, that I am watching my breath." It's very interesting that the Buddha continued to practice breath meditation. So I will certainly try to pattern myself after the Buddha and spend a good deal of my time in my seclusion watching my breath. I will also make good use of the new enclosed walking meditation path in my kuti. Since the time of the Buddha, it has been considered important for monks to practice both sitting and walking meditation in order to maintain the health and balance of their practice. If one is living exclusively as a contemplative monk, one needs to move the body around as well. We do this by simply walking back and forth in a limited space of 30 or 40 feet. It is very refreshing to the body and fosters a different quality of mind than that of a sitter's practice. I will also probably have some volumes of the Pali Canon in my kuti and will carefully and enjoyably read a few suttas per day. Although I have read most of the main teachings of the Buddha, it's always good to go over them again to allow them to percolate and to see what comes up spontaneously in stillness when one encounters the words of the Buddha. In short, I will live a very simple life devoted to deep meditation in silence and solitude. Somehow, I hope that my students, and even those who read this article, will benefit from the mere idea that somebody is in peaceful seclusion for a year. Somehow, I hope that you can keep this image in your mind and even visit me in your mind as I sit peacefully and quietly in my kuti. Somehow, I hope that the image of one who is peaceful, who is devoting day and night to the cultivation of deep stillness, can come to your aid in the middle of a frantic day. That's one of the reasons for contributing to this article. By this means, others who come to know about my retreat can participate simply by bringing this image to mind. This is the value of this pure contemplative retreat. So solitary retreats, watching similar practices leading to quiescent mind, are not without their value and can be very beneficial not only for monks, but for lay people as well. But let's return to Lama Yeshe, who claims that with bodhicitta, the more we are involved with people, the more pleasure we will experience. "People become the resource of your pleasure," he says. "You are living for people. Even though some still try to take advantage of you, you understand. Well, in the past, I took advantage of them many times too, so it doesn't bother you." If you take a proper look deep into your heart, you will see that one of the main causes of your dissatisfaction is the fact that you are not helping others as best you can. When you realize this, you'll be able to say to yourself, I must develop myself so that I can help others satisfactorily. By improving myself, I can definitely help. Thus, you have more strength and energy to meditate, to keep pure morality, and do other good things. You have energy because I want to help others. And that is why Lama Tsongkhapa said that bodhicitta is the foundation of all enlightened realizations. Also, bodhicitta energy is alchemical. It transforms all your ordinary actions of body, speech, and mind, your entire life, into positivity and benefit for others, like iron transmuted into gold. I think this is definitely true. You can see it's not difficult. He says it's easy to see the difference in people's faces when they develop a strong positive outlook. Human beings are actually very simple, he says. Some are a disaster within, and it shows on their faces and makes those whom they meet feel sick. Others, even though they are suffering intensely, always put on a brave face because they are considerate of the way others feel. I believe this is very important. What's the use of putting out a miserable vibration? Just because you feel miserable, why make others unhappy too? It doesn't help. You should try to control your emotions, speak evenly, and so forth. Sometimes when people are suffering, they close off from others, but you can still feel their miserable vibration. This doesn't help. To help the people around you, you have to maintain a happy, peaceful vibration. This is very practical, very worthwhile. Sometimes we talk too much about enlightenment and things like that. We have a long way to go to such realizations. Forget about enlightenment. I don't care about Buddhahood. Just be practical. If you can't help others, at least don't give them any harm. Stay neutral. Anyway, what I'm supposed to be telling you here is that bodhicitta is like atomic energy to transform your mind. This is absolutely scientifically true, and not something that you have to believe with blind religious faith. Everybody nowadays is afraid of nuclear war. But if we all had bodhicitta, wouldn't we all be completely secure? Of course we would. With bodhicitta, you control all desire to defeat or kill others. And as Lama Jade Tsongkhapa said, when you have bodhicitta, all the good things in life are magnetically attracted to you and pour down upon you like rain. At present, all we attract is misfortune, because all we have is the self-cherishing thought. But with bodhicitta, we'll attract good friends, good food, good everything. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, if you're going to be selfish, do it on a grand scale. Wide selfishness is better than narrow. And what did His Holiness mean? He was saying that, in a way, bodhicitta is like a huge selfish attitude. Because when you dedicate yourself to others with loving kindness, you get a lot more pleasure than you would otherwise. With our present usual selfish attitude, we experience very little pleasure, and what we have is easily lost. With great selfishness, you help others, and you help yourself. With small, it's always me, 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 and it's easy to lose everything. The main point, then, is that when you contact Buddha Dharma, you should conquer the mad elephant of your self-cherishing mind. If the Dharma you hear helps you diminish your self-cherishing even a little, it has been worthwhile. But if the teachings you have taken have had no effect on your selfishness, then from the Mahayana point of view, even if you can talk intellectually on the entire Lam Rim, they've not been much use to you at all. He goes on to say that fundamentally we are lazy, but then he corrects himself. Well, maybe not lazy, he says, but when we finish work, we are tired and don't have much energy left. So when you come home from work, lie down comfortably and meditate on bodhicitta. This is most worthwhile. Much better than rushing in speedily, throwing down a coffee and dropping onto your meditation cushion to try to meditate. It doesn't work that way. Your nervous system needs time and space. You can't be rushing through traffic 1 minute and sitting quietly meditating the next. Everything takes time and space. It's much better to have a quiet, blissful cup of coffee, and don't pressure yourself either. That too is very bad. Don't punish yourself when you're too tired to meditate. I should be meditating. I'm very bad. You destroy yourself like this. Be wise. Treat yourself sympathetically with loving kindness. If you're gentle with yourself, you will become gentle with others. So don't push. Pushing doesn't work for me. That's why I tell others not to force themselves. We're dealing with a mind, not rocks and concrete. It's something organic. The Western environment offers lots of suffering conditions that act as causes for our actualizing bodhicitta. So life there can be very worthwhile. For example, it's much better to subdue an adversary with bodhicitta than with a knife or gun. When attacked, you can practice loving kindness. We could also do this in the monasteries of Tibet, where there are often horrible monks. I don't think that Tibet was full of only holy people. We had unbelievably wild monks there that nobody in authority could subdue. If you would try to control them wrathfully, they would get only more aggressive. But Arya Bodhisattva monks, people who had completely given themselves up for others, would treat them with loving kindness, and the wild monks would calm down completely. They would feel, "This man loves me, he has great compassion, he has given up everything for others and has nothing to lose." In that way, aggressive people would be subdued, without authority, but with bodhicitta. There are many stories about this kind of thing, but I'm not going to tell them now. Perhaps you think they're funny, but it's true. You can conquer your enemies, both internal and external, with loving kindness and bodhicitta. It is most worthwhile, and there's no contradiction, but the totally comfortable path to liberation and enlightenment. In his text, Lama Chöpa, the Panchen Lama says, "Self-cherishing is the cause of all misery and dissatisfaction, and holding all mother sentient beings dearer than oneself is the foundation of all realizations and knowledge. Therefore, bless me to change self-cherishing into concern for all others." Now, this is not some deep philosophical theory, but a very simple statement. You know from your own life's experiences, without needing a Tibetan text explanation, that your self-cherishing thought is the cause of all your confusion and frustration. This evolution of suffering is found not only in Tibetan culture, but in yours as well. And the Panchen Lama goes on to say that we should look at what the Buddha did. He gave up his self-attachment and attained all the sublime realizations. But look at us. We're obsessed with me, 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 and have realized nothing but unending misery. This is very clear, isn't it? Therefore, you should know clean clear how this works. Get rid of the false concept of self-cherishing and you'll be free of all misery and dissatisfaction. Concern yourself for the welfare of all others and wish for them to attain the highest realizations such as bodhicitta, and you'll find all happiness and satisfaction. But it doesn't claim that developing bodhicitta is easy. Easy things bore you quickly, he says. It's quite difficult, but there's no way you'll get bored practicing it. People need to be most intelligent to actualize bodhicitta. Some, though, have no room for it. Forget about yourself and have little concern for others, they'll ask. That's not my culture. It's very difficult to change holding yourself dear into holding others dear instead, the most difficult task you can undertake. But it is the most worthwhile and brings the greatest satisfaction. After practicing some meditations, such as impermanence and death, for a month, you'll say, "Oh, I'm tired of that meditation." But you'll never get tired of meditating on bodhicitta. It is so deep, a universal meditation. You'll never get tired of bodhicitta. And that is all we have time for today. Thanks for joining the program. Hope to be with you again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential we have created to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.